You've heard the headlines. Get some perspective now with Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Hey, good morning and a happy Thursday to you. We're going to go ahead and jump into the show today with the news yesterday of a halting of separating of families, but it leads to a whole rash of new questions.
The Lead, brought to you by Burge Ford, off the U.S. 60 and Mesa Drive.
That's right, Bruce. There are a lot of questions, as well as some new developments. We know that the House is expected to vote on a couple immigration bills this morning. We're monitoring that for you. We're also hearing down in McAllen, Texas, that a civil rights group attorney says federal prosecutors unexpectedly dropped misdemeanor charges against 17 adult immigrants who crossed the border with their children. Now, they don't know if the families are going to be reunited immediately or released altogether, but the president is also expected to speak here soon, just one day after signing that executive order to keep illegal immigrant families together.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say there's still a lot of questions going on right now regarding the practical implementation of this change in policy or this reversal of previous 7-week-old policy. But also, you know, the thing that struck me, and you touched on it a little bit in the discussion we have, is there are still, I don't know, what's the final number of children?
2,300.
2,300 children in federal custody who have either presented themselves unaccompanied or been taken from their parents pending.
These 2,300 have been separated from their families. They're not unaccompanied, yes.
How will and when they be reunited with their parents?
Fantastic question, and good luck getting an answer on it. Because it doesn't appear as though there is actually any plan in place to do this. This is what has been really striking to me as you try to figure out what is going to become of those 2,300 kids. It appears as though the Department of Health and Human Services doesn't have a plan. And the reunification is going to be quite difficult to do if there is no said plan.
Yeah. I saw the results, a piece from an assistant federal public defender. So there are, you can imagine, when people are charged with these immigration crimes, these are federal crimes, they are, if you can't afford an attorney, one will be provided for you, right? So they get a federal public defender. And he said, he says, in a typical meeting, this is a federal public defender in El Paso, Texas. He said, people would ask, how much time am I looking at? What do these charges mean? Is my judge fair? Should I go to trial or plead guilty? He says, those are not the questions we're getting. He said, the questions we're getting today, and he admits, questions he can't get an answer to. A federal public defender are, where is my little girl? Who's taking care of her? When do I get to see her again? Will they deport me without her? How will she be protected and by whom? How can I talk with her? Who will give her medicine if she's sick? And this is a federal public defender saying, I'm not used to sitting in front of clients and not being able to answer any of their questions, because when he goes to ICE, ICE can't answer those questions.
It's pretty shocking as well. Walter Schaub is the former attorney of ethics in the White House. He's one who actually left because he said the United States was becoming the laughingstock of the world
when it comes to ethics,
exactly. And he has been trying to get some answers as well as to what happens to these children. How do they get reunited? And it's amazing the lack of information that's out there. Now, what I have been able to determine is that it is quite possible that these children, that their parents get deported without them. That the mom...
Wait a minute. This is happening, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Adults, parents are being deported. They've been charged with this criminal misdemeanor of being in the country illegally. They've gone before a judge. Their case has been adjudicated. They're being deported, put on a bus, a plane, whatever. But their child is still in the United States?
The parents are being prosecuted in a criminal court. the children are going through the immigration court. So the criminal case may get settled before the immigration case. If the criminal case gets settled before the immigration case, then that individual can be deported while the child is still going through the immigration case. So, yes,
wow.
We are seeing instances of parents being deported while their children are remaining in the United States.
I don't even understand how that can happen. I'm just playing that out in my head. You showed up with your child. You leave, and your child is somewhere. I can't imagine the horror that parents would feel at that.
Yeah, you think? It's incredible. And
wow.
So that's where a lot of these questions are now remaining, is with the 2,300 kids who have already been taken from their parents. Now, the president yesterday signed an executive order.
We're signing an executive order. I consider it to be a very important executive order. It's about keeping families together while at the same time being sure that we have a very powerful, very strong border, and border security will be equal, if not greater, than previously.
Okay, so he signed that executive order. He could have just picked up the phone and called DOJ and had this stopped, but he signed an executive order instead.
Uh-huh.
The reason why that distinction is important, Bruce, is because it is quite possible, folks, that in 3 weeks we find ourselves right back to where we were yesterday. Why?
Really?
Because you hear a lot about the Flores settlement.
Uh-huh.
And the Flores
yes.
settlement states that a child can only be detained for 20 days before they have to go into like, you know, a foster or some other kind of program. If you are now having the parents and the children detained together, which is what this executive order does, we're not exactly sure where they're going to be housed because they can't be housed with ICE.
The Flores settlement also says children can't be housed in an adult facility.
Okay. So, and if they're being housed in their situation isn't remedied within 20 days because their parents' case hasn't been heard in criminal court
now
within
what?
20 days.
Now you're violating the law.
So now do you separate those children?
Wow. Wow. I got to tell you, and I want to share you this, Pamela, of what it sounds like or what it looks like inside these courtrooms. Because we know that parents, in many cases, who their children have been taken from them, are going before a judge. They're making an asylum plea. They're making whatever it is, right? This, and again, this comes from this a federal public defender, said he was cross-examining the customs agent, the ICE agent. He said, I asked if this female agent was aware that my client was arrested with a 4-year-old daughter. She said no. Okay. I asked the agent, are you the lead investigator? She said yes. I asked if it had become known to her that my client had a 4-year-old child. Yes, she said. But then she said she didn't know that the 4-year-old was a female. The judge in this case glared at the agent. He goes, this is how it goes. I ask about the child. The government objects. The judge forces the agent to answer. The answer is always the same. Do you know the location of the child? No. Did you provide my client with information as to the location of the child? No. Did you provide my client with any information as to how they could go about finding their child? No. The judge actually said, and he said in this one case, the judge says, I can't understand this. If someone at the jail takes your wallet, they give you a receipt. They take your kids and you get nothing, not even a slip of paper. That is a federal judge admonishing an ICE agent in federal court in El Paso, Texas. But it shows, this shows how screwed up it is.
What it shows me is that when this administration decided to go to a zero tolerance policy, they made the decision one day, they put it into effect the next, and they didn't do a lot of the legwork necessary for what that zero tolerance policy was going to entail.
Practical.
Okay, so you're going to have zero tolerance policy. You're the president of the United States. If that's how you want to interpret immigration policy, you can do that. But have policies and procedures in place so that there is documentation when you are separating children from their parents as to how they are reunified. I haven't seen anything that shows there's any kind of policy or any kind of practice in place for reunification to happen. Now, we've heard that it has been happening here or there, and the reason being because there are some amazingly dedicated caseworkers who are on this working to reunify these parents, but that seems to be the exception, not the norm.
The Lead brought to you by Burge Ford off the US 60 and Mesa Drive, online at burgeford.com. So what happens next? We're going to talk to an immigration attorney, one of these people representing these very folks here in Arizona.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
You know, we're trying to understand what next, what happens next. And joining us on our KTR Newsmaker line is Eric Biotvet. And Eric is an immigration attorney right here in Arizona. Full disclosure, Eric and I go back quite some time. Eric, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I don't know if you got to hear a little bit of what we were talking about, but one of the questions, Eric, is in the world of immigration, in the world of these people in the country illegally, they've been charged with a misdemeanor, as I understand it, and are appearing in court, some having their children taken from them. We're trying to understand the what's next. Did yesterday's change in policy, yesterday's executive order, did it fundamentally change, I'll use the example, your job as an immigration attorney?
Not really. What's happened here is Trump has dictated that families will stay together in detention, but it hasn't changed the rules as far as having those family members released or applying for benefits and that sort of thing.
Well, and Eric, just to follow up on that, we understand, and this goes back to this Flores case that I'm assuming you're a hell of a lot more familiar with than I am, that there are rules and there are criteria when it comes to holding people, how long you can hold them, the type of facility you can hold them in?
Yes, the court held that there should be a least restrictive setup for these children. So you don't want to put them, you know, in jail cells and that sort of thing. You want to have it more of a, you know, friendly atmosphere, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And I think what's going on now is by identifying parents of these children, they can bring the parents in and make it more of a family-oriented setup.
You know, I've got a question for you here, Eric, because I feel like sometimes facts are hard to come by when it comes to immigration. We know that the Flores, you know, settlement, that's been around for decades now. And previous administrations have, you know, been sometimes separating families. This isn't the first time it's happened. Other times we hear about the catch and release program where ankle monitors or you're expected to show up to court mm-hmm. whenever your date shows up. And I've really been trying to find numbers, concrete numbers, without an agenda from some sort of organization as to what percentage of people who have been caught and then released actually show up for their court date. As an immigration attorney, I know you can't speak for the whole system as a whole, but with your clients, what percentage actually show up for their court date?
Well, for my clients, they all show up to court because they're pursuing benefits and they would like to get relief in the United States. But as far as statistics go on how many people do not show up, I don't know of any records kept by the government on that other than indirectly, because when somebody does not show up to court, then they get ordered deported and that becomes a record against them. So
right.
Somebody somewhere is probably keeping track of that, but I'm not aware of anything.
So you, and so in your experience, Eric, if I you are, and as an immigration attorney, people are coming to you specifically. So yes, of course they're going to court because they're the ones, they came to you for goodness sakes. They are trying to, I'm assuming they're trying to either get lawful status or citizenship in some way, shape or form. And you're helping them navigate this in some way, shape, or form.
Exactly. A lot of these people will come to me who are caught at the border for asylum. They're seeking asylum. And usually what will happen is that at the border, if they'll be given a credible fear interview, and if the officer, asylum officer, believes that they have a credible fear, then they'll release them and they can see an immigration judge. If they don't have that credible fear, then they will send them to immigration court while they're still in detention for a hearing and then a decision from the judge as to whether the case goes forward or they get returned.
Local immigration attorney Eric Biotfet is joining us right now, and you talk about the credible threat. We also heard that recently those criteria had changed in some way, shape, or form. Are you feeling that? Are you seeing that? And how are you as an immigration attorney dealing with that?
I've actually seen the criteria a little bit more liberal, but I tend to see that with children and female detainees. I was in El Paso for a situation very similar to that, and the lady did not have a very strong case that I saw, but she was granted a credible fear interview and determined to have a credible fear, and she was released, and she's now in Phoenix, and she will be going to court.
I got one last question for you here, Eric, because we are up against the clock. But, you know, you talked about getting asylum. We see that in this executive order that the president signed yesterday. It is the same policy that they have been telling folks from the beginning. If you want to seek asylum, do it the right way. Come to a port of entry. Make the declaration. Don't try to cross the border illegally. But we're hearing stories of folks who are trying to do just that, and they're being turned away, told to come back another day. Being in this, coming to this country and seeking asylum is not a crime. So my question is, how do you slice it both ways? You're telling people to do it the right way. As they choose to do it the right way, they're being turned around. Is there a better situation that folks who are trying to seek asylum could go through? Or is this a bit of a shell game by the administration?
You know, it really sounds like a shell game. And it's just a tough call, because when you have all these people that come to the border and not enough officers to review their cases, then you have to detain them. It just goes on. It's a complete nightmare. The only thing I could think of is they could actually go to the American embassies in the countries that they're in and ask for refugee status, which is different than asylum. Asylum you apply for in the United States, but you can ask for a refugee status at the American embassy. And I think a lot of these people just are not educated on, you know, the laws.
Yeah.
Of course, they're not going to be, because they're trying to escape their country. So it's a lot of miscommunication and just manpower.
Wow. Hey, Eric, thank you so much. By the way, great talking to you. It's been forever and a day. You know, Eric Biotfet, an immigration attorney, literally representing some of these people in front of these things, going to these hearings, credible threat hearings. Wow. And I think you hear from him. It's a kind of a screwed up system. It's tough to navigate. I do agree that the people coming here probably are completely unaware of the laws or unaware of any changes in them. And probably irrelevant to them on a certain level. They're trying to get away regardless. Do you trust your Siri or your Alexa to do your banking? Okay, even I'll draw the line at that. We'll talk about it next.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
It seems like maybe once a week there's a new feature, or maybe there's a new machine or app out there. These virtual assistants, voice activated, things that are supposed to make your work or home life or commuting life easier or better, right? That computers, artificial intelligence are going to help you in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, but should you have them help you with your banking? No. Bruce loves these kinds of devices,
these
digital assistants. I hate them. We'll never have one in my home. So the idea of allowing a virtual assistant like Siri or Alexa to manage my finances with my bank, yeah, not happening in the Hughes household.
I'm waiting for you to get off my lawn.
No, I'm just trying to, like, I'll protect my money, I'll protect my security, I'll protect my privacy. I don't need some assistant digital thingamajig listening to me 24/7, which they do.
James Corden wonders if Siri, Google Home, and Alexa have gone too far.
Nobody was saying, you know, I like my Alexa. I just wish you would follow me into the bathroom and stare at me while I shower.
But we've just learned something else they can do: help you keep track of your money. U.S. Bank is the first to let you check your balance and pay your bills just by asking. Credit card companies Capital One and American Express have also set up skills that let you do that. What about safety? Security experts say they'll be more worried when the devices gain the ability to transfer or actually pay out money.
Oh, geez. All right. So we've got technology expert and syndicated radio show host Kim Commando chiming in on this, talking about these devices. And You got to be aware of a couple things here, folks.
And of course, the manufacturers say, well, they're not always listening. They're just listening for the wake words. Well, the bottom line there is that, well, they are in fact listening, and they are recording every single thing that you say.
Hence the reason why I won't have one in my house.
Love
you can
it.
Say, get off my lawn as much as you want.
Yeah.
This is creepy,
Alexa,
to as creepy as they can get.
Alexa, play KTAR.
When we talk about the creep factor of this, though, I don't know if I believe this story, but let's have a little fun with it. In San Francisco, there's a 30-year-old guy. There's always a guy, right? He was going to sleep, was lying down, and he says that his Amazon Echo blurted out this chilling message. Every time I close my eyes, all I see is people dying.
Come off of it.
He says that the Alexa was in the living room.
This guy has bigger problems.
He had Amazon Prime on his TV, but it was paused. Mm-hmm. Walked back into the kitchen, and she made her statement. And this kind of, okay, I don't know necessarily if I believe this either, but remember when Alexa was doing this?
Oh,
creepily laughing?
People said that Alexa would creepily laugh, like, out of the blue. Like, all of a sudden.
Middle of the night.
My Alexa will talk from time to time.
Like, randomly?
Yeah. But and I'm assuming that, like, there was a wake word on TV or I said something. You know what I'm saying? I'm assuming that.
Oh, it's you. Yeah, it's you. It's your fault.
Well,
yeah.
I don't care. You know what I do? Alexa, shut up! That's what I say.
So, all right. This guy says, Alexa, unprovoked, said,
yeah.
Every time I close my eyes, all I see is people dying.
I know what that reminds me of.
What does it remind you of?
I see dead people.
Decidedly what it reminds me of.
Yeah.
I see dead
people. Okay, so was he listening to a little baby face?
Got
and
a little
then
baby face going
was he
on.
Watching like the Sixth,
Sense
on television?
There's dead people everywhere. Yeah.
I have just closed my eyes. I see dead people.
And straight Dreamweaver on us there. Yeah.
Oh.
I think this guy's making it up. He's looking for a payday. But listen. I get, you know, it's like you can't have it both ways. If you do like these assistants and you do want the convenience of them, you know, being able to say, Alexa, call mom, you know, it actually does that you have to acknowledge a certain amount of that they're going to be listening to things. And again, it comes down to do you trust what is on the other side of that?
No, I don't.
To do it. And I do. Yeah. I mean, Alexa has my, by the way, Amazon has my credit card number also.
Credit card, one thing, having them manage so much of your life and listening all the time.
They know everything I order.
It is, knowing what you order and listening to conversations that you have with your significant other or like really personal things that are happening in your home. Yeah, no, thank you.
Yeah.
And hearing creepy laughs in the middle of the night and unprovoked saying things.
I wish my Alexa would creepily laugh in the middle of the
night.
You're
just weird. That's why.
I would, because then I'd have a good story. I'd be able to come in and go, guess what? Mine laughed at me. Mine won't laugh.
Oh,
maybe
man.
My Alexa doesn't have a sense of humor. Maybe that's my problem.
Could you yell at her to shut up all the time?
Well, when she just starts talking randomly, like, you know, seriously, and I can't be the only one, right? Like, there must be things like on television or things that you say in passing that must sound like the wake word, which is Alexa. And Alexa hears it like in a complete another room because I'll be, you know, I'm watching TV or playing a video game or something and I'll hear the distance from Mars to Hooter. And I go, who the hell asked you? Shut up.
Yeah. Well, see, that's why she doesn't have a sense of humor is because you're constantly yelling at her.
Tell her to shut up.
Yeah.
Get off my lawn, Alexa.
Oh,
I don't talk
man.
To Siri, though. I should talk to Siri more. I think she probably misses me. I used to talk to Siri.
I don't know about that. Well, you're cheating on her with Alexa.
No, there is that.
You found another woman.
Deal with it. Yeah. Alexa does more for me. Sorry. Is what it is. The Me Too movement. One of my criticisms from the beginning of it is that everybody gets lumped under the same umbrella. And there are certainly degrees of bad behavior, criminal behavior. Do you know who Chris Hardwick is? TV presenter, podcaster. He's gotten scooped up in the hashtag Me Too movement, but there's a lot of women coming to his defense. That makes me feel awkward. Now I don't know what side to be on. We're going to talk about it coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
Arizona's News Station. KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
I'm certainly not going to assume that everybody knows who Chris Hardwick is. He's a stand-up comedian, television host, podcaster. I think he's one of those things, if you show it a picture of him, that people go, oh, that guy.
Okay, because we were talking about this. I'm like, yeah, I have no idea who Chris Hardwick is. And then I looked at a picture of him, like, ah, that's the guy who hosts the show The Wall. It's a game show. It's called The Wall.
He also, I say famous for in some way, shape, or form. Like, I remember after Breaking Bad and some of these other, like, episodic shows, he would do, like, the after show where they'd have the actors in and they talk about Walking Dead.
He did Talking Dead, which was the talk show after The Walking Dead.
Yeah, they have, like, a half-hour show after the episode of Walking Dead where you can get together and discuss it with other fans and actors. So that's him. That's Chris Hardwick.
He also does stand-up. I saw him do stand-up
four months ago.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to be his turn in the barrel right now.
Why?
Chris Hardwick's cable talk show is on hold.
On the show tonight, three delightfully talented young men.
And he has withdrawn as moderator of AMC and BBC America's Comic-Con panel, says AMC Networks, over what the media outlet says are troubling allegations by his former girlfriend, actress Chloe Dykstra. In an online post, she claims sexual assault and emotional abuse against a man whom she didn't identify. But she included details about his age and work history that led some to link her allegations to Hardwick. He denies her claims and says he's heartbroken.
Yeah, and I think one of the dangers of this is, and I was brought to this story not because I pay attention to Chris Hardwick, because I was like, I think I know who that is, but because I had seen and heard from multiple women, and maybe that's what stuck out for me, Pamela, multiple women defending Chris Hardwick. So it made me go back to go, okay, well, they obviously aren't defending Bill Cosby. They're obviously not defending Harvey Weinstein, kind of these poster children for the Me Too movement. So why are they defending Chris Hardwick? What is different about this story? There's a lot different about this story, and I think it's a fair argument to make that you shouldn't lump everybody. The Me Too umbrella shouldn't be as big as it is, that it's unfair to label. And I think if you're being even critical, you could call it mentally abusive, you could call it mean, you could call it inappropriate. Is it the same as rape?
Well, I don't know. Okay, so you just heard there in that ABC piece that we just played for you here that she is alleging, emotional and sexual abuse.
Yes.
I don't know what the sexual abuse is.
Hardwick has said never happened.
Of course, in these situations, there's always a he said, she said. I'm simply stating, I don't know what those allegations of sexual abuse are that she has levied against him. That could change my opinion of this situation. If this were, and I don't mean to sound like insensitive mm-hmm. when I say if this was just emotional abuse, that would be a different story. But let's go with that for a second.
Okay.
She has claimed, and these are the claims that I am aware of. Like I said, the sexual abuse, unaware of. Got to dive into that a little bit more. But she is claiming that there was mental torture involved, that there was controlling behavior involved, that she was forbidden from talking to other men. She wasn't allowed to speak in public. I mean, some really strange, odd kinds of situations. Now, for me personally, as a woman, when I think of hashtag Me Too, my perception, and women, you may have a different perception right. of this, but to me, hashtag Me Too is that unwanted sexual attention from a guy who might be in your circle of friends or a colleague at work or somebody out on the periphery, not somebody you're in a relationship
with. Outside of a relationship.
Yes.
Now, from a stranger to, somebody you're applying for a job with.
Again, when you're talking about like Harvey Weinstein, he was a producer who preyed on women.
Who wanted to get ahead in the industry, who wanted a
sure.
job.
Sure. Bill Cosby, same thing. Matt Lauer, same thing. Fill in the blank, same thing. To me, that is rightfully part of the hashtag MeToo movement. This, to me, may fall more along the lines of domestic abuse.
Okay.
And so I have a difference between hashtag Me Too.
Does it matter that she was in the relationship with him for 3 years and that the relationship ended, I think it was roughly 4 years ago, because she admittedly cheated on him?
No, none of that matters.
None of it matters.
None of that matters.
Got
because
it.
Domestic abuse victims will stay in relationships, even though the average person wonders why it happens. But okay, ladies, what do you think of all of this? Is there a difference between domestic abuse and hashtag Me Too? I don't know if this necessarily falls into that category. Chime in. 602-200-2733. It's our open mic line. 602-200-2733.
I believe in due process. I'll take Chris Hardwick's word as much as hers.
Yeah, I believe in what women say.
Yeah, I don't take their word for gospel. Yeah, I think she has plenty of reasons to lie about it. What is actually in the immigration bills that are being proposed, possibly even voted on today in Congress? We'll talk about it next.